Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading today from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essays on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the advent of World War II. On Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, at about 7 o'clock, Admiral Husband Kimmel, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, woke up at home in Malakai Heights above Pearl Harbor. He was planning to play golf with Lieutenant General Walter Sort, who was in charge of defending military installations on the Hawaiian Islands. Unshaven, still in pajamas, the blue-eyed, gray-and-blonde, wide-shouldered Admiral Kimmel answered the telephone. His duty officer, Commander Vincent Murphy, told him of a report that the U.S. destroyer Ward had sunk a hostile submarine a mile from the entrance to the Pearl Harbor base. Admiral Kimmel was so accustomed to hearing similar reports, which were later proven false, that he did not warn the Army. As the Admiral donned his white uniform, Murphy called him back to warn that the destroyer Ward had just halted a sampan. Then a yeoman shouted, "There's a message from the signal tower that the Japanese are attacking Pearl Harbor, and this is no drill." Rapidly buttoning his tunic, Kimmel rushed onto the lawn of his neighbor, Captain John Earle, which overlooked Pearl Harbor's battleship Row. Kimmel and Earle's wife froze when they saw Japanese warplanes flying in figure eights to bomb the American vessels. The planes were so close that the rising sun could be seen on the wings. His face stony white, Kimmel knew something terrible was going on, because this was not a casual raid by just a few stray planes. The sky was full of the enemy. With horror, he watched the battleship Arizona lift out of the water, then sink back down, way down. Kimmel had his driver speed him to his office. From there, at 8:12 in the morning, he sent an alert to the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Harold Betty Stark, stating, "Hostilities with Japan commenced with air raid on Pearl Harbor." While looking out of a window at the chaos and destruction, Admiral Kimmel was struck near the heart by a spent machine gun bullet, but so lightly that the round bounced off his chest and fell to his feet. Already suspecting that he'd be one of those blamed for the Japanese attack, he said, "Too bad it didn't kill me." According to one witness, Kimmel then reached up with both hands for his four-star shoulder boards and tore them off. Especially compared with the ignominious way it would end, Kimmel's career had started with promise. Born in 1882 in the Kentucky tobacco town of Henderson, Kimmel graduated in the top quarter of his class at the U.S. Naval Academy. In 1914, during the occupation of Veracruz, Mexico, ordered by President Wilson, Kimmel was wounded in the arm and both legs. The following year, during a trip to San Diego, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Roosevelt, Kimmel's elder by 1 month, took him on as a temporary aide. Kimmel later recalled that Roosevelt and his wife were very charming, but he grew tired of holding Mrs. Roosevelt's coat. In November 1918 in Scotland, as executive officer of the dreadnought USS Arkansas, Kimmel watched the final surrender of the German fleet. In January 1941, after Kimmel had served on the Navy's budget officer and commander of three light cruiser divisions in Hawaii, President Franklin Roosevelt chose him as commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet, which included ships in both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Kimmel wrote Admiral Stark that he was perfectly stunned, having not expected that job in his wildest dreams. Kimmel later told his niece that he was awfully scared by his new responsibility. The reason for the vacancy was that the previous October, Kimmel's predecessor, Admiral James Richardson, had protested Roosevelt's decision to move the Pacific Fleet from San Diego and Long Beach, California, to Pearl Harbor. The president insisted that the new location would provide deterrence against Japanese militarists. But Richardson warned him to his face at the White House that putting these ships in the middle of the Pacific would make them more vulnerable to attack. Stung by Admiral Richardson's infantry, Roosevelt removed him. President Roosevelt's choice of the more amenable Kimmel, whom his colleagues called Kim, was a bad mistake, putting a solid but prosaic and unimaginative officer into what would turn out to be one of the world's most important commands. Communications between Washington and Honolulu, almost 5,000 miles apart, were primitive. So much would hinge upon Kimmel's ability to think on his feet. But this admiral was, by nature, far too content to wait for orders from the War Department. At 1:40 in the afternoon that day in Washington, D.C., which was 5 hours ahead of Honolulu, President Roosevelt was lunching with his close aide, Harry Hopkins, in his private oval study upstairs at the White House. Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox called to report that Pearl Harbor was under aerial attack. This was the first time since the War of 1812 that another country had successfully launched a major military assault on the territory of the United States. The president knew instantly that the United States would now have to enter a world war of unimaginable magnitude. He ordered Secretary Knox, "Find out, for God's sakes, why the ships were tied up in rows." Roosevelt's White House study, like other rooms at the mansion and the family's spacious Victorian home at Hyde Park, was adorned by framed naval and war scenes. As an adolescent, Franklin Roosevelt had begun to amass what the New York Times in 1961 called the world's largest known collection of American naval prints and paintings. Roosevelt owned the earliest surviving portrait of John Paul Jones, whose biography he had once attempted to write, and what were called the only sketches made during combat in the Mexican War by a gunner on the U.S. sloop of war, Cyane. Roosevelt loved to collect ship models as well as books, pamphlets, and documents related to his country's naval history. The president's maternal ancestors, the Delanos, had made money on clipper ships plying the Chinese trade, including opium, but his forebears had not fought in the War of 1812, the Mexican conflict, or the Civil War. Roosevelt's father, James, although 32 when the struggle between North and South began, did not join the Union Army. He hired a substitute. Young Franklin Roosevelt's fascination with war was stimulated by his fifth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt. As a student at Groton, captivated by news accounts about the Rough Riders in Cuba, Franklin Roosevelt imitated Teddy Roosevelt by wearing a stylish gold pince-nez and exclaiming, "Bully." When Theodore and the Rough Riders paraded through New York City, Franklin Roosevelt cheered along with the crowd. He later claimed, had he not been confined in the Groton Infirmary with scarlet fever, he would have volunteered to fight the Spanish in Cuba himself. On St. Patrick's Day, 1905, in Manhattan, the 23-year-old Franklin married Theodore's favorite niece, Eleanor. By then, his cousin was president, and in the absence of her late alcoholic father, Elliot, Teddy Roosevelt gave away the bride. Before long, Franklin was telling other clerks in his New York City law firm that although he was a Democrat, he would follow his cousin Theodore Roosevelt's political path from the New York legislature to the White House. His son Franklin Jr. told me in 1978, "My father spent his whole life competing with Theodore Roosevelt." As a New York State Senator in 1912, the Democratic Roosevelt campaigned for Woodrow Wilson. Teddy Roosevelt was running for president that year on the Bull Moose ticket, but with respect for ambition, bore Franklin no ill will. When Wilson won the presidency, Franklin successfully lobbied for Theodore's old job at the Navy, explaining that, "All my life I have loved ships," and that as a boy, he had wished to attend Annapolis. Franklin Roosevelt knew that being Assistant Secretary of the Navy would lend him a military patina that, as Theodore Roosevelt had shown, could enhance his political future. At the Navy, Roosevelt's genial, long-suffering chief, Joseph Daniels, knew that his hyperactive, sometimes insubordinate young deputy, on whom he doted, yearned to be president. Franklin quickly became the champion of a much larger U.S. Navy, while Daniels gravitated towards the pacifism of his hero, William Jennings Bryan. At the end of July 1914, when war was nearing in Europe, Roosevelt rushed back from his family's summer respite on the Canadian island of Campobello. He wrote Eleanor that a complete smash-up is inevitable, and that his chief totally fails to grasp the situation. He added, "These are history-making days. It will be the greatest war in the world's history." The assistant secretary was alarmed that nobody seemed the least bit excited about the European crisis. Secretary Daniels, feeling chiefly very sad that his faith in human nature and civilization and similar idealistic nonsense was receiving such a rude shock. He complained to Eleanor that Secretary Daniels and Williams Jennings Bryan had as much conception of what a general European war means as their little son Elliot had of higher mathematics. When war enveloped Europe, Roosevelt boasted to his wife, "I am running the real work, although Joseph Daniels is here. He is bewildered by it all, very sweet, but very sad." Repeatedly, Roosevelt told his superiors, "We've got to get into this war," to which Secretary Daniels would reply, "I hope not." By the start of 1917, the assistant secretary could see that the United States was on the verge of entering the European conflict, and he hoped for a major role. On New Year's Day, he reached into his personal cache of historical artifacts and chose one as a gift for President Woodrow Wilson. It was a memorandum scrawled by James Madison's Secretary of State, James Monroe, at the time of the War of 1812, warning that a submission too long protracted would have no other effect than to encourage and accumulate aggressions until they became altogether intolerable. Eager to curry favor with the historian president and to signal his eagerness for bold action, Roosevelt wrote Woodrow Wilson that James Monroe's argument was an interestingly parallel to the events of the day. During the first week of March, Roosevelt went to the White House and asked Wilson for permission to bring the fleet back from Guantanamo to be cleaned and fitted out for action. Wilson refused, explaining that he had tried every diplomatic means to keep out of the war and would do nothing now that might constitute an unfriendly act against the Central Powers in Europe. Wilson told Roosevelt that he wanted the definitive historian writing in the future to conclude that war had been forced upon us deliberately by Germany. When Wilson finally went to Congress in April 1917 to seek a declaration of war, Franklin and Eleanor were in the chamber. Eleanor recorded that while listening breathlessly to the president, she felt half dazed by the sense of impending change. Uncle Theodore Roosevelt, recalling his own experience of 1898, told Franklin, "You must resign. You must get into uniform at once." As Secretary Daniels later recalled, Franklin thought actual fighting in the war was the necessary step towards reaching the White House. But Wilson told Daniels to keep the young man in his place, adding that neither you nor I nor Franklin Roosevelt has the right to select the place of service already assigned by the nation. During wartime, Roosevelt advocated a plan to build a fence of anti-submarine mines to close off the North Sea, which Wilson called shutting up the hornets in their nest. Using 22 million pounds of explosives, the fence, when built, extended across the English Channel and between Scotland and Norway. It destroyed half a dozen or more German U-boats and helped to crack the morale of the German Navy. In the summer of 1918, Roosevelt insisted on touring the French battlefront himself, and he risked bombardment by enemy artillery in the English Channel. His esteemed war record, combined with his famous surname, youth, and political strength in what was still the nation's most populous state, led to his nomination for vice president in 1920. The following year, at Campobello, Roosevelt was struck by polio. As he tried to recover the use of his legs, and with his faithful aide, Lewis Howe, planned his return to national politics, he benefited from his association with the heroic sailors who had risked their lives during the World War. But Roosevelt did not advertise Howe behind the scenes. He had been one of the chief and earliest officials pushing Wilson to enter the conflict, which so many Americans now considered a ghastly, hubristic mistake. A month after Roosevelt was elected governor of New York in 1928, when he spoke at a banquet for the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, of which he was an officer, Roosevelt carefully praised only aspects of the late president's war leadership that most people deemed above reproach, such as Wilson's probity and his refusal to send young Americans to Europe until they had been properly trained. When Roosevelt ran for president himself in 1932, with the nation stilled by the Great Depression, Americans were not, luckily for him, very interested in his role in Wilson's crusade. Disguising his internationalist tendencies, Roosevelt stressed his efforts while in Albany, New York, as governor for economic reform and relief, and he defeated President Herbert Hoover in a landslide. His experience under Wilson had shown him how a president could use a national emergency to enhance his authority. Thus, in his inaugural address, although the crisis he faced was domestic, the new president reached at once for the metaphor of military conflict, asking for broad executive power to wage a war against the Depression as against a power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe. During his first term as president, Roosevelt tried to rescue the American economy, relieve widespread suffering, and reform the broken financial system. The public made it clear that it was more isolationist than ever. In 1934, responding to charges that the Morgans, DuPonts, and other merchants of death, concerned with iron blood and profits, had schemed to force the United States into the Great War, the Senate formed a special committee to investigate the munitions industry, chaired by the isolationist Republican Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. In March 1935, Roosevelt met with Nye's panel at the White House, claiming that he had come around entirely to respect William Jennings Bryan's view on American neutrality. That August, recognizing the nation's anti-war fever, he signed a bill demanding an arms embargo against all belligerents in case of overseas conflict, no matter who appeared to be the aggressor. In 1936, the president sought a second term against the Kansas governor Alfred Landon, who urged Clouds to mind our own business. Roosevelt was loath to get on the wrong side of the vast isolationist vote, which included so many of his own party. That spring, he and Eleanor Roosevelt gave an annual White House garden reception for disabled veterans. Some of the guests were pushed through the receiving line in wheelchairs, while, as usual, the standing president, using his hidden leg braces, his cane, and the arm of a military aide, pretended that he was not still similarly affected. When Adolf Hitler's forces remilitarized the Rhineland, Roosevelt felt unable to act dramatically. Speaking that summer to a national radio audience from the encampment at Chautauqua, New York, he pledged to shun political commitments which might entangle us in foreign wars and to avoid connection with the political activities of the League of Nations. Almost echoing the Merchants of Death narrative, Roosevelt warned that production for a war market may give immense fortunes to a few men, but for the nation as a whole, it produces disaster. Stating, "I wish I could keep war from all nations, but that is beyond my power. I can at least make certain that no act of the United States helps to produce or to promote war." In the most attention-grabbing part of his speech, Roosevelt suggested that his personal experience during the Great War had made him an enemy of military confrontation. "I have seen war," he declaimed with rising emotion. "I have seen blood running from the wounded, men coughing out their gassed lungs, the dead in the mud, 200 limping, exhausted men come out of line. I have seen children starving. I have seen the agony of mothers and wives. I hate war." Roosevelt did not mention that he had viewed such horrors merely as a civilian official sightseer touring the French battlefront. Unfamiliar with his personal history, Many listeners no doubt presumed from hearing these words that their president must have actually fought in Europe, like so many of them and their family members. That number, he was reelected in a landslide against Alf Landon of Kansas. In the summer of 1937, Japan invaded China. Speaking that October at a bridge dedication in Chicago, the capital of Midwestern isolationism, Roosevelt warned that innocent nations are being cruelly sacrificed to a greed for power and supremacy which is devoid of all sense of justice and humane considerations, stating, if such behavior spread throughout the world, let no one imagine that America will escape. Roosevelt suggested a possible international quarantine of peace-loving nations to oppose the contagion. The Washington Post praised Roosevelt's assurance that the United States has not forgotten all moral standards in its ostrich hunt for security. The Baltimore Sun newspaper agreed that the president's plea was not to be shirked merely because it is hard. But the isolationist Boston Herald newspaper warned Roosevelt that he sounded too much like Woodrow Wilson, stating, for the sake of several millions of American mothers, confine your crusading to the continental limits of America. Don't get excited, implored the Nevada State Journal. Chilled by the failure of many congressional Democrats to endorse his appeal, Roosevelt confided to his aide and speechwriter, Samuel Rosenman, it is a terrible thing to look over your shoulder when you are trying to lead and to find no one there. That December, Japanese bombers sank the clearly marked American gunboat Panay, peaceably anchored on the Yangtze River in Nanking, China, where it was protecting local American interests. Roosevelt let it be known that he was deeply shocked. His Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, obtained from Japan an official apology, full restitution, and a pledge against similar assaults. But the attack on the Panay reminded many isolationists of how the destruction of the USS Maine in 1898 and other vessels had moved Americans to fight in 1898 and 1917. Worried that Roosevelt or a successor might exploit future such disasters, they searched for new means to bar presidents from dragging the nation into war. Democratic Congressman Lewis Ludlow of Indiana had proposed a constitutional amendment demanding that unless USS territory had been invaded and Americans injured, any future effort to take the country to war would require a national referendum. Congressman Ludlow complained to a radio audience, stating, you can cast your ballot for a constable or a dog catcher, but you have absolutely nothing to say about a declaration of war. In October 1937, the Gallup poll found that 73% of Americans favored his proposal. Roosevelt's allies had kept Ludlow's bill from reaching a floor vote, but within a day of the Panay assault in China, a majority petition dislodged the bill from the House Judiciary Committee. The president warned Speaker William Bankhead that such an amendment would cripple any president in his conduct of foreign relations. So strong was isolationism in the House, however, that an effort to allow a floor vote was only narrowly defeated. Republicans sided with Congressman Ludlow by a vote of 64-21. In March 1938, Nazi Germany annexed Austria, despite a formal protest lodged by the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who wished to appease Hitler to maintain tranquility in Europe. Privately, Roosevelt compared Chamberlain to a chief of police who makes a deal with the leading gangsters. That September in Munich, Chamberlain and Hitler signed the infamous compact that took the Sudetenland, home of 3 million ethnic Germans, away from Czechoslovakia and gave it to Germany in exchange for what Chamberlain called peace in our time. Roosevelt told intimates that the British leader and his colleagues remembered Judas Iscariot, but he did not say so in public. The Gallup poll found that Americans approved of Chamberlain's leadership by 57-43%. In Germany that November came Kristallnacht, with synagogues and Jewish homes that have flamed. Eleanor wrote her friend Lorena Hickok that the attack on German Jews makes me sick. The president sought to expand the U.S. Army Air Corps to include at least 20,000 warplanes. He privately said that if the United States had already possessed such air power, Hitler would not have dared to take the stand he did. Roosevelt sent warplanes to France and England for their potential defense, which did not violate existing neutrality laws since those states were still at peace with the Germans. Meeting at the White House with the Senate Military Affairs Committee, Roosevelt recalled that when Hitler took power, Germany was a complete and utter failure, a nation that owed everybody. Roosevelt asked, "Would any of you said that in 6 years Germany would dominate Europe completely and absolutely?" He warned that if the British and French collapse, the rest of Europe would fall to Hitler, and so would Africa and Latin America. Violating a promise he made at Munich, Hitler seized the rest of Czechoslovakia in March 1939. Roosevelt asked the House and Senate to repeal existing neutrality constraints in order to aid England and France in the event of war. But the Senate refused to weigh the matter until the following year. "Well, Captain, we may as well face the facts," his grizzled Vice President John Nance Garner of Texas advised him, stating, "You haven't got the votes, and that's all there is to it." That July, Roosevelt asked his Attorney General, Frank Murphy, how far he could go in ignoring the Neutrality Act, even though he signed it. Reading will continue from presidential historian Michael Beschloss's essay on Franklin Roosevelt and the advent of World War II. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.